Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today, Ana Mateo and Faith Perlow tell us about the tradition of places called soda fountains in the United States. Brian Lynn presents this week's technology report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first,
in 2023, if you visit a pharmacy, you might be sick and in need of medicine. If you were to visit a pharmacy 100 years ago, you might go there to buy medicine, but you might also go there for a soda or tonic, drinks with carbonated water from a soda fountain. You might also even eat lunch while waiting for your medicine. These businesses, called soda fountains, were widely popular in the first half of the 20th century. But over the last 70 years, most soda fountains have closed. There are still a few soda fountains out there, however. One is in Canova, West Virginia. It is called Griffith and File Drug. The business is 131 years old. Rick Griffith is the owner of the soda fountain. He is keeping the tradition going. He explained that soda fountains were not just a place to eat lunch. It was a place where you had an experience. When you had a soda fountain, people would stay longer. They'd sit down, and they'd share stories, Griffith said.
Both Griffith and his daughter Heidi are pharmacists. Pharmacists are people who prepare and give out medicines in a store or hospital. Their pharmacy employees work in the back of the store, while the front is a restaurant and soda fountain. The restaurant offers daily lunch and dinner choices. People go there not just for the food and drinks, but they also take in the retro surroundings. There is a jukebox that plays music, neon pink signs, vintage chairs, a metal ceiling, and black and white pictures. Carbonated drinks became popular in the 1800s. Acid phosphate drinks were later developed. Pharmacists would mix acid phosphate into the drinks for those seeking treatments. This is why soda fountains were often found in pharmacies. As soda fountain manufacturing improved, so did the recipes and flavors. Food choices were then added. As customers waited on their prescriptions, they were able to eat and have a soda. Behind the soda fountain counters are soda jerks, the people who prepare old-fashioned phosphate drinks. They are not called jerks because they are mean. The term jerk also describes the movement that is used to pull the device on the soda fountain machine that makes liquid come out.
Mally Jarrett and Nathaniel Fornash are the soda jerks at Griffith and File Drug. It's fun working at a place like this, watching all the customers come in, looking around, taking a step back in time, and telling me about how a lot of them used to work here when they were younger, Jarrett said. During the late 1950s, many small family-run pharmacies started changing their business practices. Soda fountains were replaced with shelves for food and home supplies. Government rules became stricter. And fast food restaurants and large pharmacies became the norm. Pharmacies with soda fountains could not keep up, and many closed forever. A few stayed open as either ice cream places or gift stores. Some closed either the soda shop side or the pharmacy side of the business. In the past 5 years, many of the country's oldest soda fountains, like the Highland Park Soda Fountain in Dallas, Texas, and the Central Drug Store in Bessemer City, North Carolina, shut down.
But in recent years, there has also been a return of soda fountains. Rick Griffith does not have any memories of his father's original soda fountain. That is because it was removed in 1957, when Griffith was just 9 years old. In 2004, he put another soda fountain in his store. After he reopened the soda fountain, he recalled a man and his granddaughter sitting in a booth. The man shared stories about his younger self many years earlier. He would sit at the same booths after school and order a cherry Coke. Griffith recalls the look on the granddaughter's face as wonderful. She'd never thought of her grandfather as ever having been young. He was always her grandfather. Griffith is glad to offer a place for people to sit around the soda fountain and share stories, instead of just getting fast food. I'm Faith Perlow from Morgantown, West Virginia.
And I'm Anna Mateo from Weirton, West Virginia.
Researchers say they have developed a small printing device that can produce vaccine patches for COVID-19 and other diseases. Since the device is movable or mobile, it could be easily deployed to areas of the world that face difficulties receiving and storing vaccines, the scientists say. Researchers from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT, led the development of the printer. While the developers say it will likely take years to become widely available, some experts are calling the technology exciting. Creators of the device recently reported their development results in a study in the publication Nature Biotechnology. The device prints 2-centimeter-wide patches that each contain hundreds of tiny needles that administer vaccine material when pressed against the skin. The team says such patches offer major improvements over vaccine shots given in the arm. Users can easily self-administer the vaccines, and they are mostly painless. The patches could appeal to people resistant to traditional vaccines. They can also be stored at room temperature for long periods of time. The popular mRNA COVID-19 vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna need to be kept cold in refrigerators. This has made it hard to get them to parts of the world that lack the ability to keep the medicine cold, especially developing countries. Some of those nations criticized the unequal sharing of vaccine shots during the COVID-19 pandemic. The researchers said the new printer was tested with the Pfizer and Moderna COVID-19 vaccines. But the goal of the international development team is for the device to be used for other vaccines as well. Robert Langer is the co-founder of Moderna and one of the study's writers. He told the French press agency AFP he hoped the printer could be used for the next COVID or whatever crisis happens. Anna Jaklinek is a researcher at MIT and another co-writer of the study. She said in a statement that the devices could someday establish on-demand vaccine production. Jaklinek added, if, for example, there was an Ebola outbreak in a particular region, one could ship a few of these printers there and vaccinate the people. Microneedle patch vaccines are already under development for COVID-19 and a series of other diseases, including polio, measles, and rubella. But the patches have long struggled to expand because producing them is a costly, labor-intensive process that often involves large machines. The researchers developing the new process said they shrank the process down by using smaller equipment to create the patches. Currently, the team said the printer can produce 100 patches in 48 hours. But researchers say experiments have shown that with improvements, the printer could print thousands a day. And you can have more than one printer, Langer added. Joseph DeSimone is a chemist at California's Stanford University who was not involved in the study. He said the work is particularly exciting as it realizes the ability to produce vaccines on demand. DeSimone has invented his own versions of microneedle patches. He said if the printing process can be widely deployed, it can help bring widespread access to RNA vaccines. Antoine Flahault directs the Institute of Global Health at the University of Geneva in Switzerland. He told AFP that production and access to vaccines could be transformed through such a printer. This, Flahault added, could become a real breakthrough. Flahault noted, however, that the success of the method will first require government approvals and mass production, and that could take many years. I'm Brian Lynn.
Brian Lynn joins me now to talk more about this week's technology report. Thanks again for being here, Brian.
Sure, Ashley. Thanks for having me.
This week's report dealt with a newly developed device researchers say can print vaccine patches for COVID-19 and other diseases. The idea of a vaccine patch in general seems to be quite new, right?
Yes, that is correct. The report notes that this kind of delivery system for vaccines is still in development, not only for COVID-19, but for additional diseases as well. but the development process for the patches has been slow, and it will likely take a long time for them to get government approval and be deployed.
I know the report also mentions the lack of pain is one reason why some people might be less resistant to a vaccine patch. In what other ways might these patches be better for some people?
One of the main improvements would be, as stated in the report, that these printing devices could be deployed to rural areas without the need to keep the vaccines cold, and people could also easily administer the medicine by themselves.
Well, thanks again, Brian, for being here to discuss this week's report.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ashley.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In recent programs, we talked about how the rise of fascist leaders in Europe threatened American neutrality in the 1930s. Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party in Germany created the most obvious threat. But there was also Benito Mussolini in Italy and Francisco Franco in Spain. These leaders challenged both the idea of democracy and the security of some of America's closest allies. Hitler's invasion of Poland and the spread of war in Europe in 1939 made Americans wonder if they could remain neutral much longer. The United States would finally go to war against Hitler and the other Axis nations. But its first battle would not be in Europe at all. Instead, the United States would enter World War II following a surprise attack by Japan on the large American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Relations between the United States and Japan had grown steadily worse throughout the 1930s. Both nations were important industrial powers, but they had very different ideas about the economic and political future of East Asia, especially China. Until the late 1800s, Japan had been a nation with ancient political traditions and little contact with the Western world. Visits by Commodore Matthew Perry and American warships helped open Japan to trade with the United States and other nations in the 1850s. And in the years that followed, Japan took major steps toward becoming a modern industrial nation. By the 1920s and 30s, Japan was a strong country, but it lacked oil, rubber, and other natural resources of its own. For this reason, Japanese political leaders looked with envy at the Dutch, French, and British colonies across Southeast Asia and the Pacific. And Japanese business leaders saw huge markets for their products in nearby countries like Korea and China. Japan's desire to use East Asia to gain natural resources and sell manufactured products was in direct conflict with American plans for Asia. This was especially true concerning China. Washington created an open-door policy toward China. It wanted to keep China's natural resources and markets free from control by Japan or any other nation. For this reason, Americans were very concerned when Japanese forces invaded the Manchuria area of China in 1931. and they watched with great interest the efforts of Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek to oppose the Japanese invaders. The United States was also very concerned about protecting its imports of oil, tin, and rubber from Southeast Asia. This area of the world was a major supplier of these resources in the 1930s. The Middle East had not yet become a leading producer of oil. In these ways, the United States and Japan were competing for the same resources and Asian markets. However, there also was a good deal of trade between the two nations. In fact, Japan depended on the United States for most of its metal, copper, and oil. This trade with Tokyo became a major concern for President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Congress in 1937. In the summer of that year, more Japanese troops moved into China. They quickly captured much of the Chinese coast. Much of the metal, oil, and other materials that Japan used for its war effort in China came from the United States. Americans did not like selling Japan materials to use against China, but the trade was legal because of a 1911 agreement between Tokyo and Washington. However, the American government told Japan in 1939 that it would end the earlier agreement. It would no longer sell Japan materials that could be used for war. Washington's decision made the Japanese government think again about its expansionist plans, and the announcement a month later of a non-aggression treaty between Germany and the Soviet Union gave Tokyo even more cause for concern. The Soviet Union could be a major opponent of Japanese expansion in East Asia, and it appeared free from the threat of war in Europe. These two events helped moderates in the Japanese government to gain more influence over foreign policy. A moderate government took power in January 1940. However, this period of moderation in Tokyo did not last long. In the spring of 1940, Germany launched its Blitzkrieg, or lightning invasion of Europe. The Nazis captured Denmark, Norway, the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, and finally France. Extremists in the Japanese government saw the German victory as their chance to launch their own attack on European colonies in Asia. They quickly began negotiations with Hitler to form a new alliance, and within months, militant leaders overthrew the moderate government in Tokyo. The new Japanese government was headed by a moderate, Prince Konoye, but the Minister of War was an expansionist, General Tojo. Tokyo wasted no time in taking action. It forced France to give Japan permission to occupy northern Indochina. And Tokyo also demanded that Britain close the Burma Road to the Chinese city then known as Chungking. The Burma Road was a major route by which the United States was supplying China with munitions as part of the Lend-Lease Act. These events caused relations between Tokyo and Washington to become even worse. In the second half of 1940, President Roosevelt banned the export of metal and oil products to Japan. His administration also lent money to China. America began to supply Chiang Kai-shek's government with a fleet of P-40 fighter airplanes with volunteer pilots led by Army aviator Claire Chennault to train Chinese pilots. The squadron became known as the Flying Tigers. American representatives quietly began to meet with British and Dutch officials to discuss joint defense plans for possible Japanese attacks in the Western Pacific. Washington and Tokyo held long negotiations in 1941. The American officials hoped the negotiations might delay Japan from launching an attack to the south. They also thought that a delay might give more moderate leaders in Japan a chance to gain more influence. And, for a time, the American plan worked. Japan did not make new acts of aggression. Again, events in Europe caused this situation to change. Nazi Germany attacked the Soviet Union in the middle of 1941. This prevented Moscow from doing any fighting on its eastern borders, so Japanese troops were free to invade southern Indochina. President Roosevelt reacted to Japan's invasion of Indochina by taking three major steps. First, he took control of all Japanese money in the United States. Second, he brought the armed forces of the Philippines under American command. And third, he closed the Panama Canal to Japanese shipping. Once again, a conflict developed between moderates and extremists in the Japanese government. More moderate leaders, such as Prime Minister Konoye, urged one more effort to reach an agreement with the United States. But the Japanese Army and Navy believed that the time had come to go to war to end American and European power in East Asia forever. Negotiations between Japan and the United States continued through the final months of 1941, but the two nations were on the edge of war. They were as close to hostilities as Washington was with the Nazi government in Berlin. American military officials captured secret messages from Japan during this time. They learned that Tokyo was planning an attack of some kind unless the United States suddenly changed its policies. However, the American officials could not discover exactly where or how the attack would be made. Almost everyone in Washington expected that the Japanese would attack south of Japan. They were wrong. The military leaders in Tokyo were planning a surprise attack on America's main Pacific military base at Pearl Harbor.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.